Well, joining me back on the program today is Jeff Blankfurt. Books and links are below. Mr. Blankfurt, welcome back to the show. I think you're tied with Pepe Escobar as most frequent guest.
happy to be back, Ryan.
There's a lot going on, especially in Israel. I want to ask about what's going on in Israel, but first, some lesser news. It's not lesser news, but it's gotten less attention. I want to ask you your opinions on BDS, and I also want to talk about the Presbyterian Church and their divestment campaign, because that has been going on for a dozen years or so, and it seems like they finally went forward with it. So could you explain what's been going on with the Presbyterian Church, and then let's talk about BDS some more.
Yeah, yes, happy to do that. A few weeks ago, the Presbyterian Church, in their General Assembly, voted 310 to 303, close vote, to remove their investments, that the church has investments at all, is other than church vestments, but their investments from three companies, American companies, that do business in Israel, Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, all of them which provide assistance to Israel in maintaining its illegal occupation of the West Bank. Caterpillar is the most notorious because it has a special huge P9 bulldozer that is used to bulldoze Palestinian homes, Bedouin homes, and the others provide, one provides surveillance information and the other on Palestinians, and the other provides protection for illegal Jewish settlements. Now, the struggle within the Presbyterian Church has been going on for years. There's some really great Presbyterians I know in the San Francisco Bay Area who have been really, really struggling to do this. I remember they brought Ilan Pappe out to speak in San Francisco. There's a whole section of the church that really believes in Christianity as Jesus was supposed to have taught it. They think what Israel is doing is wrong and not defensible.
It's an enormous amount of money.
Well, actually, the church and those three had $21 million invested in those three companies, which is not a small chunk of change. And the reaction after so many years, and by the way, many of these Presbyterians have been to the West Bank and Gaza. They have seen up close what Israel has done to the Palestinians. And they've decided they had enough. And this is a major... This major fight has been going on year after year, and at each one of these conventions, you have a whole delegations or from the Jewish establishment there to tell the Presbyterians what they should be doing, and guilt-tripping them, because if you're a Christian, you're responsible for the Holocaust. As a European, if you're a white European, you're considered responsible for the Holocaust. And
wasn't it mainly Christians that fought the Germans and Italians and Japanese too, though?
Well, that's beside the point.
Okay.
we're not talking about reality. We're talking about the projection that the Christian church is responsible or co-responsible for the Holocaust, because the Europeans and the Christians, they exclude the Christian evangelists who support Israel. They never get criticized for this. Of course, they weren't even around then. But for years, the Protestant church has been a bulwark of support for Israel in the United States. Although many church members complained about that, and you have Christian peacemaker teams over in the West Bank in towns like Hebron, who I've met with, by and large, the churches went along, guilt-tripped by Jewish leaders, and they had these interfaith dialogues between Christians and Jews, in which it basically the Jews are reminding the Christians of the obligations they have to Jews, and it's usually pretty much of a one-way street. Now, the time has come when some of the Presbyterians, or enough of the Presbyterians, said we've had enough of this, and what Israel's doing, it cannot be defended. Now, instead of responding to this vote by the Presbyterians in an intelligent way, in understanding and respecting the Presbyterians, you had various spokespersons in the Jewish establishment outright attacking them. You had a man, a rabbi in New Jersey called named Shmuley Boteach. He used to be a friend of Michael Jackson. He calls himself America's Rabbi. He wrote a scathing attack on the Presbyterians that appeared in the Jerusalem Post and in the Jewish press across the country, in which he referred to the Presbyterians as a rotting corpse. In
because
Los
they
Angeles,
won't give their money to these companies?
Yes. I mean,
it's their money. They don't have to invest in anything.
No, you're quite correct, but you're speaking logically. When this issue...
Give me money or you're an anti-Semite.
That's what it... Well, if you're taking money away from Israel in any fashion, you become an anti-Semite. And so...
giving somebody your own money isn't taking money away from them. It's just keeping your money.
You're
speaking
logically.
Again, I'm being logical. Yeah. Right.
You're speaking logically.
We're talking about a rabbi.
When you talk about a rabbi, you...
So they already don't live in reality.
There's a small group that does speak logically, and they rarely get heard. They don't represent the Jewish establishment. But one of the most important organizations in the establishment is the Seaman Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, which runs something ironically called the Museum of Tolerance. This outfit is one of the most intolerant outfits, operations.
You know, they labeled it that so they could get city financing for their Holocaust museum by saying, well, it's not just for the Holocaust, it's for everything, but 99.999% of it is Holocaust stuff. And they had a fake film in there. They had this film they had this film in there about the German gas vans, and it was taken from a fictional Polish film. I mean, it even had camera shots from, like, inside the trunk of the gas van and stuff, and they just clipped the credits off and had it in the museum like that actually happened, and they were rounding Jews up in vans, and they had a pipe going from the exhaust pipe, like, into the truck, and had mobile gas chambers. And it got called out on it by David Cole secretly found out who actually made the film and told him, and that guy finally got it removed. But I wonder if it's back in there now. I'd like someone to go in the Museum of Tolerance and see if they've replaced it or not. But there's kinds of fake stuff in the museum.
This is an operation that really is like a snake oil salesman, anything to get money out of the public.
It's the Holocaust industry. I mean, it's a horrible thing what happened, but they're using it just to make money.
They're abusing it, and I'll get back to it in a moment. But I just wanted to make the comment, the response of the Museum of Intolerance and Abraham Cooper. They have two rabbis, named one named Marvin Heyer, and the other Abraham Cooper, and it's really difficult to know which one is less ethical than the other. But Cooper co-authored an article in which he said that the deliberations at the Presbyterian meeting could have taken place under Joe Stalin's Russia. Now, I don't know if Heyer was there or Cooper was there, but in all these events, representatives of the Jewish establishment have been allowed to speak and present their cases. And this has been going on for years. And so what it shows to the Presbyterian and to Protestant denominations is that they are not going to be allowed to do what they want to do and say what they want to say if it's critical of Israel. And I suspect there's going to be a number of other churches that are going to think more about divestment, particularly after what's happening now in Gaza.
Those companies, it's not just the Israeli occupation, it's also in Burma and other places where the same, Caterpillar and Motorola,
right,
the same crooks are involved. So
it's
more than just that. I mean, Israel's the major one, but plenty of other despots, and it's the same kind of system, the same kind of MIC gambit where they profit from conflict and misery. So a church should not be invested in those things.
This is actually a real question too, is why the church had investments in companies like this in the first place, particularly when...
I wonder how many of their followers know churches have stocks.
Probably not a lot.
I doubt it, yeah. And universities, too. They do the same thing. Universities have investments in war industries and things. And you would think, why don't you, you know, pay the teachers more or buy things for the students or...
And charge the students less.
Yeah. But what they do is they gather money and invest it in bulk.
For a little digression here, one of the reasons the college campuses have been quiet to the Iraq War for years is not just because there's no draft, but I believe, this is like a conspiracy theory, that in order to keep students from protesting, they have to make the fees so high that the students are obliged or their families are obliged to take out loans. And if you get in trouble, the loan is called in. And so students going to school have such a nut on their back that they simply cannot afford to sit in and get arrested. Now, when I went to college, UCLA, the tuition was really, really cheap. I could make it in 1 week's work at a newspaper. I mean, and professors' wages have not gone up that significantly, but what's gone up is administration wages. Mm-hmm. And the tuition, which is extraordinary. You know, $20,000-$30,000 a year for students to go to college is outrageous.
It's because of guaranteed student loans. When you guarantee a loan, you guarantee the price will rise because they go, oh, the government's going to pay or the bank's going to pay. Then this is the new price.
And then they invest that money in war materials, in war industries. Yeah.
They went to Halliburton and things during the Iraq War. I went to the KBR and disgusting. And they went up about 33%. It was crazy. But it's a no blank Sherlock investment to invest in war industries before war. So they did.
So they did. And so we see. Well now you see the investments that 11 countries have made in the F-35 stealth fighter that cost about $100 million a pop and doesn't seem to be working very well. 11 countries have invested millions of dollars, Australia, Norway, Italy, Britain, Australia. Of course, Israel is going to get theirs, but they don't invest any money there of their own, obviously. No. And they're going to get some of these countries, like Israel or England, are getting contracts. So this is a plane being put together by a committee, so to speak.
Which is why it doesn't work.
And they keep having problems with it. Matter of fact, the Israelis are having second thoughts about getting them because these other countries may not use theirs, but the Israelis like F-16s because they could use them, and they could use them to go and bomb houses in Gaza. But they're very humane, very humane. Before they bomb the house, they call, if they have the cell phone number, they call the cell phone number of the owner of the house or the family. And if they don't have the cell phone number, they send a text message. And they only they can't send a text message. Then they do what's called knocking on the roof, in which they drop a bomb that has no explosives in it to let the people know if they don't get out of there in a few minutes, the house will be blown to bits. And that's really humane of them. I mean, and they're advertising this as example of their humanity, saying what other country, Air Force, will let people in the house know before they blow the house up? But then how many countries Air Force are blowing up at people's houses?
Yeah, you know? How many Air Forces are attacking civilians anyway? They just blew up a cafe while people were watching soccer.
Right.
Wiped out a whole family except for one 10-year-old boy.
You know. And I'll tell you, I have a problem with Hamas, though.
Hamas is not Palestine.
Hamas is not Palestine, and they have all these new rockets that can go longer distances. What they're allowing to do is Israel test its Iron Dome system, which was set up with largely funding from the United States. But it and unfortunately Hamas is not Palestine. A Hamas spokesman publicly telling people that they should stay out and make themselves into human shields, it seems, which is really stupid and really dumb. But they're not the first people. It's not the first dumb thing they've done. I would say,
well, Israel created Hamas and gives them all the attention.
They created them to be a religious counter to the secular PLO, and the reason that they got elected in 2006 was because it was a protest vote against the PLO's corruption, and that because of during the Second Intifada, rather than fighting a traditional guerrilla war like Hezbollah did in Lebanon, they went and blew up buses and restaurants and killed civilians inside Israel. And while you could understand the frustrations of Palestinians who were being killed by Israelis, what that led to, unfortunately, was giving Israel an excuse to build a wall that is not likely to come down, that in fact is a border for...
The wall's not even on the border. It cuts into Palestine.
It became a new border, but the truth of the matter is that's not enough. Israel, since 1967, has been one country. From the Mediterranean, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, it has been one apartheid country. And every inch of it has been ruled by Israel. And the idea that the Palestinians gave to Israel in Oslo 62% of the West Bank for that Area C, Arafat's agent, his name was Mahmoud Abbas, whatever happened to him? Oh, he's the president of the Palestine Authority, I forgot. Mm-hmm. 62% of the West Bank was given, in a sense, and for all practical purposes, was given to Israel, was legitimized by Arafat, which was in violation of international law to acknowledge that the Israelis had any right to be there at any time, is what the Oslo Agreement did. And Arafat, I don't know, I probably may have mentioned it the previous time, was rewarded handsomely by getting $8 million paid into his private bank account every month. And this was, I read about it first when the famous prisoner of Zion, quote unquote, I say quotes around because the Israeli Palestinians are the prisoners of Zion, but Natan Sharansky, or Anatoly Sharansky, who was in the Israeli cabinet, complained at a meeting of the cabinet that they should not give Arafat is $8 million a month anymore, because Arafat was not running a democratic Palestinian authority, which is kind of a joke. But when it comes to the Middle East and Israel-Palestine, nothing is logical. But according to something called the Jewish Virtual Library, Arafat had received $375 million from Israel, which accounts for how his wife or ex, his widow, can live in luxury in Paris. But this was, there are people who still defend Arafat and refuse to acknowledge the fact that he sold the Palestinians out in Oslo, and which in fact can be seen as a second Nakba. Mm-hmm. And they set up this Palestinian Authority. They ended resistance to the occupation, and the role of the Palestinian Authority police was to protect Israel, which it has. It's been helping Israel, quote unquote, find these abducted teens, and that's another strange story.
Yeah, that is a very fishy story. I don't know if you have read Max Blumenthal's report on how Netanyahu knew they were dead already and whipped up a frenzy. But when you look at, well, I'll ask you about it, when you see who actually killed them and who actually found them and how they were caught. It really breaks down the timing on it right after the new union government's in place. They need a pretext, and then they got one. And it was really suspicious. What do you think about that whole ordeal? It just couldn't get lower with the revenge killings. Do you know they actually tried to blame, when they burned that kid alive and tortured him, they tried to blame his own family? Before they,
right. I'll comment on that as well. First of all, we constantly hear, and the Israelis tell us, that the West Bank is filled with Hamas terrorists. What are three Israeli teens doing hitchhiking on that road outside of Hebron at 10:15 at night? I mean, this is a serious question. I mean,
well, all three of them were colonists too.
Some of them lived. Well, I'm not sure where all of them lived, but the fact is, they were really coming from the yeshiva, and their parents were really concerned about them. Why were they hitchhiking in a road that's considered dangerous, and we're told is dangerous by the Israelis, and then when one of them, we're told they're kidnapped, one of them calls the police on his telephone and says, "We've been kidnapped," and then there are shots. The police treat it as a prank. This can happen in the United States, but that it happened in Israel is just not believable. And then, of course, we have this orchestration, or what I call a choreographed operation, by the government, Netanyahu, in which first they blame Hamas, and then Nazi-like, they start mass arrests of hundreds of Palestinians who have no connection to the abduction. And this reminds me very much, who are not going to get out of prison either, administrative detention. This reminds me very much of what the Nazis did during World War II, when a partisans would off or grab a couple of German soldiers or two. The Nazis would then, usually about a 30-to-1 basis, they would go and round up a number of people, whether it was in Italy or France or someone else, and either off them or do something or put them in prison. This collective punishment is against international law, but no one has violated this much since World War II, as has Israel. And this mass arrest got so little attention in the U.S. media.
They knew they were dead. They told the families those gunshots are blanks, so to give them hope. And
you
they
hold
knew who had taken them.
It was obvious they knew that these kids were dead. They had heard the shots, but they told the Israeli press that they couldn't talk about it. And so they waited 18 days while they orchestrated, they built up this support, using it as an excuse to arrest hundreds of people, 500 people, over 300 of them members of Hamas, and including at least 50 who had been freed in the agreement over Gilad Shalit. And so this is like a double cross, but this goes with the territory, so to speak. But they were building up all this intense hatred of the Palestinians, as if they had to do that within Israel, and making these kids seem as if they were, their abduction was the biggest crime of the century. As a matter of fact, the mothers of these three Jewish teens, Israeli teens, went to Geneva to the UN Human Rights Conference and wanted them to take a position on this abduction. Now, you look around the region, let alone around the world, and you see what's happening in Iraq and Syria, in Africa. The number of people being dead, kidnapped, murdered, raped, and so on. But suddenly these three Israeli teens are something special. They need to get international attention. This is called chutzpah. But this is the mentality of Jewish supremacy that unfortunately dominates Israeli thinking and those of its supporters.
Then they after they had recordings of the shots, after they had found the car with bullets and blood in it, they knew who it was, and they didn't arrest them. They went around arresting everyone else. And it was a volunteer sort of force that actually found the guys who actually did it. It's beyond looking around the world at all the people who get kidnapped and killed, Palestinians who've been kidnapped and killed, even, and there's no attention for that. It's just, you won't even hear their name. It's just a number, and it'll be on the internet. It won't even be on television. But then we have the U.S. media showing pictures of blown-up houses in Gaza and acting like those were pictures of Israeli homes that were hit by rockets. And those rockets don't blow up houses. They don't do anything. They're worthless. They're just nothing but something to fiddle with to make money for Iron Dome and act as a pretext for whole-scale collective invasion of the entire area.
This is exactly what it is. And on the other hand, you have a situation where you see footage of two young Palestinian men shot in the back by Israeli snipers, filmed by European cameramen. And immediately, the American Jewish press and the Israeli press start calling this a film from Pallywood, as if the whole film is contrived. And it reminds me of the film of Mohammed Dura back during the Second Intifada, where the Israelis shot and killed this young Palestinian boy and spent incredible amount of money trying to prove that the Palestinian boy wasn't killed or that he had been killed by Palestinians. And it's like any time they've actually caught the Israelis committing a crime on video, they try to pretend it wasn't real, that it was all staged. Now we had this young Palestinian boy picked up and burned to death by these mad Jewish terrorists, burned to death. And as you mentioned, initially they tried to pretend that it was done by Palestinians within the family. But his cousin...
Yeah, they accused him of being gay and said it was an honor killing, which gets a lot of the liberal LGBT people to unthinkingly, you know, support the Israelis. And there's no evidence offered. And he was forced to drink gasoline. His family, I mean, the six terrorists were caught anyway, so we know it wasn't his family. But they tried to blame his own family for his death.
I know. That was the first thing they said. It was just like blaming the Palestinians for killing Mohammed Dura or staging the film of these two Palestinians being shot and killed. And then they said, well, look at the way they fell. They obviously fell knowing that they weren't really hit. They just fell on their hands to protect themselves from when they fell. But the fact is, both of these kids were dead. They were 15-year-old shot and killed in cold blood by Israeli snipers working for the state, not some individual group or non-state actor. This was Israeli state terror. And
it's on film, and they still deny it.
I know it. And then with the film of the cousin of Mohammed Al-Qadir, Tufik, who's an American citizen from Florida, being really beaten up by Israeli thugs in uniform, of course. That the existence of that video seemed to have escaped the U.S. media, who, when they reported on the story of him being beaten, was allegedly beaten. But
also, it was Israelis murdered, Palestinians died.
Exactly.
That was BBC. The American media wouldn't even admit that much. They were actually blaming, they were showing pictures of Palestine and saying it was Israel. Then they put a written retraction on ABC, but they never put one, a televised one, explaining away what they had done. But that's typical. I mean, they don't call settlements what they are. They call them Jewish neighborhoods.
Neighborhoods, I know. That's so
they
wonderful.
They forget to say exclusively Jewish neighborhoods.
But you know, some of them are not just settlements. They're actually cities.
Right, exactly.
With populations bigger than the one that's nearest to me. And it's like when Israel first took over the West Bank in 67, they were referred to as administered territories. That's how they just fell into their hands, as Abba Ibn once said.
That basic information that Israel builds Jewish-only cities, as in only Jews can live there, drive there, etc., that's that level. I mean, that's really simple, right? But that's not known by the American public, that there is a country that builds racially exclusive cities, which ought to be where you start. I mean, if you can't talk about the occupation, you can't really understand anything that's going on, but you can't get to there. But I want to say something before I forget, because you mentioned Bollywood, which is off of Bollywood, which is Hollywood, right, and so on. There is actually a film called Pallywood that had some kid like laying down next to rubble and pretending to be dead and getting this picture and then getting up later and then doing it again. They're like, see, it's all fake because they found this one kid to do that. Well, it was a stupid film, but what I noticed, which was funny, because only a month later where they had that Saddam statue toppling thing, you knew that was staged. Well, I looked at both videos, and anyone out there can do this. You can just go grab them yourself. You don't need mine, because mine was deleted up by the ADL on YouTube, along with 200 other videos. It's the same actors and same people. And so whoever it was that they hired for Pollywood is the same kids and guys that they had on that Saddam statue toppling, who were not Iraqis, by the way.
That's very
And the Americans pulled it down. And I thought that was a pretty good find that I did there, but, you know, I get maybe 2,000-3,000 views on that, and that's it. But it's out there for anybody.
Yeah, no, that's... These folks are working 24/7. And they've been doing it for a long time. As a matter of fact, going back to 1960s, early 60s, it was revealed in a hearing held by Senator Fulbright on, among other things, it was on the role of foreign countries influencing U.S. politics, and he discovered or revealed that the Jewish Agency was taking money that was donated to Israel by American Jews and sending that money back to buy public relations Hezbollah for Israel and the United States. And this is what occasioned the Kennedy Justice Department under Bobby Kennedy to make a serious effort to try and get AIPAC, or its predecessor, the American Zionist Council, to register as a foreign agent. And they really seriously tried, but they didn't succeed. And they were still trying when Kennedy was assassinated, and that was the end of that.
And Bobby was killed by a Palestinian, allegedly.
That was really, you know, it's just too convenient.
Yeah, John Pilger was there in front of him, and the guy next to him was shot. You know, bullet coming from the other direction, probably from Dane Eugene Caesar. But, I mean, his elder brother, I don't want to get into too long thing with the Kennedy, but, I mean, his brain was blown out the back of his head, and they're saying he was shot from behind. So, and it's unfelt.
I wanted to get to, actually, was one of the documents, the most important document for me that came out of that hearing was the plan of the American Zionist Council, which at that time, American Jews until 1967 were not very supportive of Israel. They supported the creation of the state, but Jews in no significant numbers were emigrating to Israel. So the American Zionist Council realized they really had to get every element of American society, every sector of American society working on Israel's behalf, supporting Israel. And so they came up with a plan, and they put it on paper, that they would penetrate, whatever you want to call it, every critical sector of American society to influence it for Israel. And they succeeded probably beyond their wildest dreams. that was, the labor unions were already part of the Israel lobby. They were a cornerstone from the very beginning, but you had the media, which was not like it is today, largely dominator control. The churches were very important, of course. The black community was very important. But every sector, they sent a Jewish writer named Leon Uris to Israel to write a book called The Exodus. This was not Uris's plan. This was a part of an operation designed to turn the American people into supporters of Israel. And they put Paul Newman, blonde and blue-eyed, to represent the new Israeli. And everybody read the book, and people went to the movie. And this kind of publicity, well, I could say you couldn't buy. They did buy it, actually, but they didn't. People didn't know that they were being conned. Americans didn't know they were being conned. You had Martha Gellhorn, who was one of the most famous American women journalists. She was Spanish Civil War, became a lover of Hemingway, but she had two loves. One was the Spanish loyalists who fought against Spain, and also Israel. And in 1951, she went for the Atlantic magazine over to Israel and interviewed Palestinians who had remained, who hadn't been ethnically cleansed in 1948. And she came back and wrote one of the most racist articles one could ever read. And I believe that she had been sent over there to do this. And what the American Zionist Council did was send a reprint of that article to every person listed by who's who in the United States. So this is the way they manipulated, infiltrated, and created an image of Israel that was totally a distortion of this reality, because it ethnically cleansed the Palestinians in 48, and it never stopped. And until 1966, interestingly, 1 year before the Six-Day War, the Palestinians who lived in Israel were living under military enforcement, military orders, for the first 18 years of Israel. Most people don't know that. And I'll tell you,
it's also very important to point out that they had Lyndon Johnson literally by the short hairs as he was having an affair with Matilda Krim.
Yeah, he was having an affair with this beautiful woman who converted to Judaism and became a, she was working, had worked for the Mossad. She was married to a wealthy Jewish donor who donated to her for Israel.
Yeah, an Irgun terrorist.
And so there was rumors about Lyndon Johnson and Matilda Krim, and supposedly he was the one who informed her early in the morning that the Six-Day War had begun. But getting back to this story about Israel before 67, this was the Israel that, by the way, Noam Chomsky considers to be as legitimate a state as any other state, no more, no less, and that despite the fact that 750,000 of Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their homes in Palestine, after 48, Professor Chomsky would have us believe that Israel cannot go back, cannot accept Palestinians. He opposes the right of return. And he recently said international law doesn't cover it, which even caused some of his sycophants, people who have interviewed him and praised him, to actually come out and said he was wrong. So Chomsky's now gone into a defensive shell, but he has been a long-time protector of Israel, doing damage control. He never refers to the fact that until the Six-Day War, in which Israel was okay, the Palestinians were living under Israeli military rule inside of Israel. And I remember when I was a kid, my parents would have visitors from Israel, American Jews, or I guess there had been American Jews, right, who had gone to live in Israel and were Zionists, and they left Israel and they came back to the United States saying they didn't want to live in a racist country, because every time there was an attack on Israel by the Fedayeen. These were Palestinians who had been kicked out of their country and were fighting back on the borders. Every time there was one of these attacks, there would be a pogrom conducted by Israeli Jews inside Israel against the Palestinians. And these American Jews who had emigrated to Israel, believing in Zionism, had left because they said they didn't want to live in a racist country. And these stories have never been told. When I went to Europe in 1966 for the first time, I ran into Israelis who had left Israel for the very same reason, that they didn't want to live in a racist country. And it was years before I met an Israeli who had anything good to say about Israel, which is quite interesting. And by the way, the 1967 war, my belief, was not fought just for the expansion of Israel to the West Bank and Gaza and to grab the Sinai. But in 1967, if you go back and read the newspapers before that, and I was alive then and read the newspapers, that they were complaining in Israel because the economy was stagnant, and then more Jews were leaving Israel than were arriving. And it was a country that was dead in the water, that American Jews, and presumably British Jews as well, but when they took a vacation, preferred to go to Paris or Rome or London or Athens, Tahiti, wherever. They weren't choosing to come to Israel.
Weeks after the UN peacekeepers were removed from the 1956 war, where France and Israel and the UK ganged up on Egypt. So right. Eisenhower had that peace agreement for 10 years, starting from 57 to 67. And so that ended in May, and in June, Israel, weeks after they're gone, attacked again. As soon as it was possible to slaughter more people, they did.
Well, and also the thing was, it's like the PNAC, the Project for New American Century, is that they said that in order to embark the U.S. and with their sidekick Israel on this major adventure to dominate the world, they needed a Pearl Harbor, which was 9/11. And going back to 67, here are the Israelis sitting around, and the country is dying from lack of new Jews coming in and Jews leaving, and a dead economy. And the American Jews, particularly who they're concerned about, were not interested in Israel. And so suddenly they realized what other countries have done at various crises is start a war. Now, they viewed American Jews as part of their constituency. When Abba Ibn came to Los Angeles and he would speak to Jews, he was speaking as their representative, and that's the way they looked at him. And so to get the American Jews stirred up on Israel's behalf, they started a war against Egypt. That was not the only reason, but I believe it was a major reason, and I have never seen this discussed anywhere. But it succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. The triumphalism in Los Angeles after the Six-Day War, and I was not interested in the Middle East at that time. I was involved actually working with the Black Panthers and working against the war in Vietnam, but I would see these big signs outside of synagogues, and you would think these folks had gone and actually, quote-unquote, liberated the Holy Land themselves, you know? So that was the greatest thing they ever done. And by the way, I tell people who...
I think it affected Jewish identity, because a lot of Jews identify with the Holocaust, and they'd always been like victims or kind of nerdy or whatever, and so suddenly they're warriors. They won a war, and
yeah,
it really changed them psychologically to say, look, we can kick someone's ass. And it's kind of like the abused kid growing up and then abusing his kid, you know. They want to be strong.
Except the Jews who were saying that, most of them had never been abused. It was interesting, some years back, in the 90s when that a group of Holocaust survivors in Israel sent a letter to the government, a petition to the government, claiming that the Palestinians were being treated as they were by the Germans in the 30s. And this was never, of course, reported in the United States. It was in the Israeli press. But they sat on this story because obviously it would be very embarrassing for Israel. When I was in Jerusalem, I was in Israel in 1983, when Menachem Begin resigned from being prime minister, and they appointed Yitzhak Shamir to be his replacement. At that time, a number of Holocaust survivors sent a petition to the government saying it was a sacrilege that this Yitzhak Shamir, who was a member of the Stern Gang, which had communicated to Hitler during the war, before just the beginning of the war, that they wanted to be his allies because philosophically they were on the same page, and that they wanted to ally with Hitler against the British. Hitler didn't return their letter, but this document was found in the safe in the Turkish embassy and it widely published in Israel. And so these Holocaust survivors wrote a letter, as they say, or sent a petition to the government complaining about Shamir being the prime minister. And it was, of course, ignored. It was mentioned in a way down in the article in the Jerusalem Post and never, never mentioned in this country. It's like it's part of the official narrative, or it's not allowed within the official narrative. And if you start talking about this kind of thing, or the collaboration between the Zionists and the Nazis, you're called a Holocaust denier, even if you don't. This has nothing to do with what the Germans did to Jews. When you start talking about other side issues that were very relevant to the situation, you can't do it. You can't do it. There is an official narrative. You cannot look at that situation in Europe as another historical event. It's this very special event, and that's why we have this whole industry built up around it.
Well, it's the war you can't criticize. It's the good war because it's the excuse for every war after it. You have to have World War II be the great good war, or otherwise you can't have new Hitlers and new wars. It ought to be looked at. I mean, just imagine if World War I and II were looked at for what they really were, colonial powers killing each other by the millions, just senseless, pointless slaughter, then you'd never have a war afterward. And no one would want to repeat that. But because of this rescue story and good guy versus bad guy and blah, 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 the Americans have been doing one war after another and continuing to kill millions of people from Iraq to Vietnam. And, of course, none of those are treated as Holocausts themselves when Asians die or Arabs die or Africans die, even if it's by the millions, because America won. Winners write the history books.
And the winners control the narrative.
And let's say they lost the Vietnam War. They didn't. Vietnam did not invade the United States. You know, they didn't lose any land. It was 55,000 versus 2 million, 3 million when you start adding up Laos and Cambodia. I guarantee you Vietnam would trade places and say, how about we attacked in America, only lost 55,000, killed 3 million Americans, and then came home. I mean, it wasn't a loss. It was just the whole purpose of that war was profiteering for helicopters and other industries. It wasn't about stopping communism. That's a joke. The winners write the history books.
And the reality is the U.S. won the war. After the war was over, there was no demand for reparations. The peace movement, our anti-war movement, which I was a part of, evaporated with the end of the draft. As a matter of fact, whether it was the intent or not of the Nixon administration, beyond ending the Vietnam War protest, the ending of the draft allowed the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War to go on as long as it has, because unless you had a member of your family or a really good friend fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq, the American people did not care anything about it. And so there are no anti-war protests on college campuses or high school campuses. I remember during the Vietnam War in Northern California, one day all the high schools and junior high schools went out in protest against the war, organized by themselves. It's kind of a frightening thing for the ruling class. And they, you know, and I suppose events like this were happening around the country, and they realized that they had to come up with a plan that would eliminate the basis of an anti-war movement, which would be young men. This is before women went in the military. Young men who would be called up to fight in a war. And you could be sure that if every 18-year-old was faced with the possibility of going to Afghanistan and Iraq, we would have had anti-war protests like the country had never seen before.
If there had been the draft and rich people's kids could die too, you'd see more. We did have a anti-Iraq war protest at my college. But it's funny to talk about this because we're still at war in Afghanistan. And well, that's been 13 years, almost 14. And they're not accomplishing anything in Afghanistan. And the other thing is they're attacking the Taliban, which is not Al-Qaeda, had nothing to do with 9/11, even with the official story. They've collectively invaded a country and replaced its government, which is, again, collective punishment. If you're going to say Osama bin Laden, who never did provide evidence for it, by the way, was responsible for the September 11th attack, that's still not Afghanistan doing it. Why do you have to replace the government of Afghanistan, and what does that have to do with the Taliban? But it was just, for most people, it's all the same. Al-Qaeda, Mujahideen, Taliban, whatever, they're all strange, wicked Muslim people or whatever. And also, so we've been here for 13 years. And then Iraq was even dumber.
You recall that before the war, Colin Powell, who wasn't part of the inside crowd that planned the war, Colin Powell paid the Taliban around $43 million to suppress the opium crop in Afghanistan.
That's right.
And they did. And they did. And what happens today? Today, the opium crop in Afghanistan are all-time record high. And so what the United States did, besides destroying the country of Afghanistan and maintaining, I mean, just, you know, the Taliban are not good guys, but going in there, what they've done is they've now unleashed untold amounts of heroin, created uncounted heroin addicts all throughout the world, thanks to that intervention. And of course, if it wasn't for U.S. intervention in Afghanistan in 1979 to overthrow the pro-Russian government there, we might not have any Islamic Jihad or ISIS or Islamic Caliphate today.
That's another big topic. We're coming at the end of the up to the end of the hour, but I'd like to have you back on to talk about ISIS and what's going on in Iraq now. We've covered the first two Iraq wars good in prior interviews rather well, but I want to talk about ISIS and how they were armed in Syria and that just the whole narrative, but we don't have time to get to it now, but that sounds like a good program for the future. And I appreciate your show. You've had some good guests on, Rally, Perry, Ray McGovern. It's been good recently.
Yeah, I've tried to get people on who aren't gonna be on the mainstream media.
Patrick,
and
want
to have something to say that needs to be said. Unfortunately, there are a couple other stations I believe who pick up my program, but my comments about the Israel lobby, which I speak about quite frequently, aren't something that other stations in other areas of the country are going to get away with playing. this is just the way it is. And I've told people who complain of my preoccupation with, let's say, the Israel lobby, I say, you know, if other media was covering this, I would be very happy to cover other things. Right. But when they're not doing it, I feel it's my obligation to do so. We'll continue to do so.
Well, it's so central. If it wasn't for the Israeli lobby, we wouldn't have had the war in Iraq. We wouldn't have had the financial collapse. We wouldn't be in Syria. We wouldn't have sanctions on Iran. We wouldn't be doing all these things. They lead back to the Israeli control of our Congress. And so, but, you know, people think we went for oil and this and that, and they don't get it. So, but what can you do? You have to.
We could talk about that. We could talk about that next time as well.
Sure thing.
Oh, well, okay. Anyway, good talking to you. We'll do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for all your time and insight.
And stay away from the typhoons and vice versa.
You too.
Take care.
Just an afterthought, and I wish Mr. Blankford was still on so I could get his two cents about it. But I was thinking back to the ABC report where they supposedly botched, although I believe it was on purpose, the pictures. And the more interesting part of that report to me was that one of the mothers of the kidnapped teenagers got on and said in English how she opposed the collective punishment and opposed Israeli violence. And they only let her talk for about 10 to 12 seconds. It was just something to think about. She speaks English, she opposes Israeli violence, her son is dead. When you put it all together with how they died and how they were found and how their deaths were used, perhaps they were anti-colonialist teenagers and were sacrificed. Who knows? It's just all very suspicious.